Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Welcome to the Association for Conflict Resolution, ACR Conversations. My name is Nancy Flatters, President of ACR. Today my guest is Dr. Bernie Mayer, Professor of Dispute Resolution at the Werner Institute at Creighton University, a scholar, researcher, practitioner, and author. Welcome, Bernie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bernie, the title of your recent book is The Conflict Paradox. That's an interesting title. What do you mean by that?
Well, it struck me as I was thinking about what we do that really makes a difference to people in conflict, that conflict almost always puts people in a paradox. Actually, in multiple paradoxes. But for one example, conflict makes us want to simplify things, to divide things into right and wrong, good or bad, and true or false. And in fact, to work our way through conflict, we have to fight against that pull. We have to try to avoid the tendency to bifurcate things, to divide things. And the essential paradox is the twin poles that are both an essential feature of conflict, but also essential to how we get through it.
Now, you also write in your book that the most important, difficult, and complicated challenges faced in conflict are the simplest and most straightforward. How do you reconcile that with what seems to be this diametrically opposed challenge between the two? And does that mean reconceptualizing the dispute in order to get around that bifurcation?
Well, it does mean that, for sure. I mean, you know, we're often told when, and I tell others myself, that, you know, the essence of being effective in conflict is to really listen to people, to really help them say what they have to say, to stay centered ourselves, to be clear about what it is that's really important to us. Those are very simple things in one sense, but to actually do them is extremely difficult. And all of the advice that we have to give to people in conflict has the nature of saying, do simple things that are extremely hard to do. And so when I've tried to figure out for myself what it is we actually do that helps with that, how do we actually make a difference that allows ourselves and others to be better at some of those things? It comes down to, in many ways, for helping people think about their circumstances and conflict differently, think about the conflict differently, and for us as interveners also to do that. So the number of different ways in which we need to reconceptualize a dispute, but one I think that may be particularly important for conflict interveners is we have to get away from thinking it's all about helping people cooperate. It is about helping people cooperate, but it's also about helping people compete. It is about helping people engage fully in conflict, which sometimes means escalating it even, in order to move the conflict forward in a more productive way. And that does mean thinking about things differently.
Well,
I often say to people who I teach that the three crutches we use to explain conflict are things that we really need to get away from. And those crutches are people behave in ways we don't like or behave the way they do because they're evil, they're stupid, or they're crazy. And fundamentally, reconceptualizing conflict means getting really away from relying on those crutches. Not that that's never the case, but it doesn't explain conflict.
So when you take a look at that as a whole, cooperation, competition, crutches, disputes are, though, grounded within topics, international, commercial, workplace, family, land, environment, and community as examples. There's many more. And people at the table can sometimes engage in destructive interactions, as you've mentioned, in terms of those crutches. They can bring hostile and competitive relationships to the table. So how do you see the translation of those interactions into ones which are more positive then, in order to move the conflict forward in its essence as an intervener?
So let me first say about the broad variety of areas in which conflict occurs. You know, clearly, you can overdo saying what occurs and what works in a family conflict also would work in an environmental conflict or an international conflict. I mean, they're all very different arenas, and each arena requires different approaches and different ways of understanding what's going on. But on the other hand, one of the reasons I think it's so interesting to study conflict and to focus on conflict is because it's such an essential part of a human experience. And it does, and there are lessons to be learned across the broad range of areas we work in that can inform each other. That's why I think like an organization like ACR is important, that tries to bring people together who work across so many different areas. And you know, I guess the second part of the question: how do you help bring a hostile, competitive relationship in a more positive direction? I think we often want to tell people stop being so competitive, stop being so hostile, and in fact, we almost have to do the opposite. We almost have to help people be angry more effectively, to be competitive more effectively. Because the paradox here is, if people do own their emotions and realize that their emotions are an important part of what they bring to the table, and if they do embrace a competitive part of what's going on and realize that is genuinely part of it, that allows people to be more cooperative, actually, to be more constructive in the long run. And so I think what that means for mediators, for example, is not to ask people to be less, you know, I'm going to use the word angry here instead of hostile, because hostile is a combination of behavior and emotions, but it's not to ask people to be less angry but less competitive, but do so understanding that they also have a cooperative approach, in fact, will also help them be competitive in some ways, and vice versa, and that the negative emotions they feel really are part of the information they bring to the table and the tools they bring to the table. I think paradoxically that in the long run helps people be much more constructive in conflict.
Well, then, how do you see the challenges of promoting a new understanding of the paradox of conflict? Because the paths can be complex, as you've noted, and rooted in complex systems of interactions. Many have long histories, troubling power dynamics. How do you deal with those things, then, within the construct?
So, again, I'm not saying any of this is something you just wave a wand and suddenly everything changes. I don't trust approaches that promote that. I think you start out by first how we understand our role in conflict. And so, for example, one of the paradoxes that I talk about is logic and emotions. And I think a lot of times in conflict we want people to be more quote-unquote logical and less quote-unquote emotional. But we know in a lot of different research and increasing understanding of just the way the brain functions, that you can't really separate those out. That they are both part of what we bring to decision making, to understanding the world, to making sense of the world, to interacting with the world. And so what I think we do in very practical ways to help people get through that is we ask people to talk about their emotions. And when people are giving and when we're asking people how to respond to an argument, a quote-unquote logical argument somebody else says, we ask them, well, how do you feel about that? Now, if you listen to that, these are natural things that we just naturally do. We're asking people to be logical about their emotions, to explain their emotions, not to give them up, but to explain them. In other words, to integrate logic and emotion. And we're asking people how they feel about logic. In other words, again, bringing emotion into the logical construct. I think you can go through all these different kinds of paradoxes that I've laid out, competition and cooperation, for example, or principle and compromise, and you see that that our most effective and powerful interventions, from the tactical level to the broad strategic level, are ones that try to bring those things together for people. That's what makes a difference in how we understand conflict. That's what makes a difference in how people understand their own conflict.
So when an intervener is working with parties, ultimately those parties are there because presumably they're seeking resolution to the conflict. And yet what I glean from some of which you have said is that you posit that that focus on getting this resolved distracts or can distract the intervener from the more important long-term work that needs to be done to deal with that enduring conflict. So how do you reconcile those two?
So this is the subject of my previous book, Staying with Conflict, which is about dealing with enduring conflict. And, you know, we are often, as mediators, put in the position of being short-term interveners in what is essentially a long-term issues. And that's both a strength and a limitation on what we do. I think one of the reasons people sometimes come to us is because they feel like we do offer a time-encapsulated service that will be helpful. However, if we're dealing with intense family conflict or a grievance in a workplace which has considerable tension between labor and management, we often have to watch out that we're not so focused on getting an immediate agreement that we are not attending to the long-term nature of the conflict that is also present, because we can do something to help people with that. We can do ways to help people understand the enduring element of conflict. And there is a danger that in looking just to get a short-term agreement about something, because that's what people say they want, we can actually make the long-term circumstance worse. And, you know, one example that's often been talked about this is how we deal with issues of harassment in the workplace. If every single time we come up with a solution to an individual act of harassment, we can actually participate in helping people avoid dealing with the larger and more serious issue of harassment. And so that's what I mean. We have to be, sometimes we have to work in a short-term context, but we have to have a very clear eye on the long-term elements of it, because we can help people contextualize that, and because we often have some important decisions to make about that.
So within the frame of even bifurcation and the codependent realities of conflict, then can you add anything more as to what the intervener, the practitioner, can do to grapple with much of this, because it is complex.
It is complex, but it's complex, but it's also simple. I mean, that's exactly a key paradox here, because I think what we do is we talk about some of this stuff we have to talk about it in a way that doesn't simply take the opposite side of where we think people are leaning too heavily. So, for example, if somebody is standing on principle in a way that is makes them extremely rigid and makes it hard for them to consider different ways in which those principles might be realized, and therefore totally unwilling to compromise, it's not our job to urge them to compromise. I mean, it's our job to help them understand the challenge of, you know, there are principles here that are important to you, and they're important to hang on to and to adhere to, And so let's figure out, as we think about some practical agreements we might make, how we can make those agreements so they help you further your principles rather than detract from them. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we do that helps people bring those things together all the time. Or on the other side of that coin, if somebody seems to be compromising in a way that doesn't seem to be in consonant with what they said their values are, their essential interests are, we have to help them connect their compromising decisions to what their longer term goals are, or their values and principles are. I think interveners do this. It's essential that we do this, and I think we do this. It's what makes a difference when we help people in conflict. But we often don't understand it, and that we're doing it. And as a result, we sometimes, often I'm afraid, fall into simply trying to urge people to take the opposite side of the paradox, to balance it out that way. And I don't think that works very well, as opposed to trying to integrate.
Right. So, Bernie, going then from the general to something quite specific, one of the seven paradoxes you outline in your book is community and autonomy. And you're speaking at ACR Conference 2015 in Reno, Nevada, at the Atlantis Casino Resort and Spa from October 7th to 10th, 2015. And your presentation is entitled that, Community and Autonomy, a Core Challenge for the Conflict Field. So what approach or focus will you be taking into your taking in your presentation that really weaves in much of what you have just been speaking about today?
All of the seven paradoxes that I lay out, which maybe I should just quickly say what they are since I've been referring to them. That's competition and cooperation, optimism and realism, avoidance and engagement, principle and compromise, emotions and logic, neutrality and advocacy, community and autonomy. They're all intertwined. They're all part of everything we do in conflict. But what I find particularly interesting about community and autonomy, which is why I want to focus on that at the conference, is that that is the essential paradox that in many ways explains human development. Developmental psychologists talk about it in one way or another all the time, about separation and individuation, for example, about learning how to create boundaries and also how to create intimacy. And I think in many ways conflict is how we interact in ways to work out our issues of separation and intimacy, which is all another way of talking about the concept of community and autonomy, how we're connected to people and how we're independent from people. And so to me, that provides an opportunity to merge some of the most important insights from developmental psychology into how we understand conflict. But moreover, I also think it's a pretty critical question in our world. We, for millennia, have been are the communities we think of and we understand and operate within are sort of on the level of clan size or maybe tribe size is better. And if we really are going to get through some of the fundamental challenges of conflict in our world, we have to have develop the capacity to have a different sense of community, of a community to connect to, and of the communities that define our autonomy as well. Because if we can't, then we cannot really think about some of the global nature of problems that face us. So to me, both this is interesting and important, both because of how it ties into global conflict issues, to global issues like climate change, like what we call the issue of terrorism, but we could frame it in other ways too, and how it connects to how we progress through life as individuals in families and communities as well.
Bernie, we only have a few minutes left, and in the time that we do have left, I want to move to the dedication in your book, in the Conflicts Paradox, is to Hopi, who is age 16 and whom you describe as wise, courageous, a good-hearted, and passionate soul, and who embodies the values of good conflict work. So within the values that Hope embodies at 16, does that give you hope in general for the future and conflict resolution? And if so, what does that look like for you?
So Hopi does that. She is passionate about making the world better, and it just frustrates the hell out of her sometimes that not all of her peers see things that way. But on the other hand, she's also able to reflect on her own feelings about it sometimes and thoughts about it in a way that's remarkable for somebody that who's growing up and who is at that age. And I think that's a great model for what we all need to do wherever we are in life. And, yeah, I you know, one of my things is on optimism and realism. One of the paradoxes is optimism and realism. And I say in it that, you know, genuine optimism requires realism, and realism without optimism isn't realism. So let me apply that to this. I am by nature optimistic. I think I often have said that being optimistic is almost an ethical obligation in the work we do. I am very encouraged by how much more broadly some of the ideas that seemed new and strange when we first embraced them many years ago, when sort of the modern iteration of our field was being developed, are much more broadly accepted. How much more kids are oriented towards, for example, working together and in school and in other ways in life. And I do feel that, but I'm realistic to know that we face some pretty serious problems in our world that we don't have the answers to, and that you know, sometimes that's daunting, and it can make people kind of want to stay away from looking at big, broad social issues, or from dealing with really heavy conflicts. And I just hope that the more and more people like Hopi say no, and take the opposite answer. You know, the issues are hard. We don't have the answers. That makes it all the more important that I engage with them. And she's certainly a model of that, and many of her friends are. And I'm very hopeful that that augurs well.
Well, our future is in our young people, and when we have young people engaged in the way Hopi and her friends are, then I do think that gives us hope for the future. Bernie, much food for thought. Thank you for this ACR conversation.
Well, thank you for inviting me to participate in it. I appreciate it very much.
And please join Bernie as well at ACR Conference 2015. For information about his presentation and many others, go to reno.acrnet.org. Thank you.
Thank you.